Leading Corporate Transformation, the podcast by WHU Ottobeisheim School of Management, powered by PwC, on the transformation of companies and their culture, from decision makers for decision makers, or from entrepreneurs for entrepreneurs.
Hello, everybody. My name is Serdan Özcan. I'm a professor of corporate transformation at WHU Ottobeisheim School of Management. And I would like to welcome you to our third episode of Leading Corporate Transformation, the WHU podcast powered by PwC. Today, my co-host is Gori von Hischhausen from PwC.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks for having me today. I'm very delighted to be part of this session today. My name is Gori von Hischhausen. I'm the co-host for PwC. I'm leading our PwC management consulting practice in Germany and also leading our finance transformation practice for Europe. I do support transformation programs as a consultant for our clients for about 20 years now, and how to lead transformation from the true top and how to start it very early brings us to our very honored great guest today.
Yeah, thank you, Gori. Our very special guest indeed today is Mr. Gisbert Rühl. Until mid-May, he was the CEO of Klöckner for over 11 years, and the transformation he brought about at Klöckner was indeed very inspiring. It's great to have you.
Yeah, thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Before we talk about your amazing transformation journey, could you please tell our listeners a bit about Klöckner and its business model today?
Yeah, Klöckner is a traditional, in principle, a traditional steel distribution company, 115 years old, so very old, in the beginning very conservative. Company when I joined Klöckner in 2005. So what we're doing at Klöckner, or what Klöckner is doing, is in principle Klöckner buys steel from the big steel companies, from the big steel producers, and is then distributing steel to all kind of customers, now, from construction to automotive, machinery, mechanical engineering. So all kind of customers who processing steel.
So looking at your time back at Klöckner, I think we can put it into one sentence. It was transformation right from since you started. For us, it's very interesting to learn because, as I said in the beginning, you started it very early. So and you were thinking about digitization very early in the process. So can you give us a little bit more background on what was the triggering event for you to start the transformation at Klöckner and to go digital right from the beginning?
Yeah, so it was not right from the beginning. So I joined Klöckner in 2005. Klöckner was private equity owned at that point in time. And then we went public already 1 year later in 2006. And then we had three great years because at that point in time, China was still a net importer of steel. So steel was relatively short. Yeah. And prices went up like hell. And that went until 2008, and then we had the financial crisis. During this crisis in 2009, I took over the position as a CEO of Klöckner. So I joined Klöckner as a CFO. So we had first, when I started as CEO, okay, number one topic was, of course, crisis management. Then we did a couple of acquisitions after the crisis. And then the question in 2014, I was questioning myself, look, this steel distribution business is a very low margin, very volatile business, difficult also in a public market. How will this business, with all these new technologies and with the platforms coming up, how will this business look like in 10 years from now? And my conclusion was it will look different. It will probably look different, will look more like Amazon, for instance. Mm-hmm. So it will be more a platform business. And that was when we created this vision of transforming Klöckner into a platform company without a plan. We only had this vision in the beginning. But this vision was, I would say, at least for a few of us, very compelling. Most of the others also in the industries were, of course, thinking, okay, that might be true for B2C and private market, but this will not work in our business, and steel business platforms have no future.
Where did the inspiration come from to turn it into a more platform business? Were there inspirations coming from the Silicon Valley, or how did you come to this idea? Because at that time, if I remember it right, or that still sometimes the fax machine was still in use for getting orders?
Yeah. So it's still used in our industry. Okay. You know, it's not, okay. Not over yet. There's a little story. So I don't know, it was in 2013 or so, I was reading or this disruption came up. Huh? And I was remembering that I was reading in the 90s a book concerning disruption from Clay Christensen. Okay. And I took this book and was reading this book again.
The Bible.
The Bible.
The Bible of change.
And then I on another occasion, I met Henry Kravis. Mm-hmm. So it was a lunch meeting, and there Henry Kravis was sitting. And when I was young, Henry Kravis was a great hero. So because he invented, at that point in time, we called it LBO, leverage buyout. And I went to him and was saying, look, Henry, great to meet you. And when I was young and so on. And then he was saying, look, when you are next time in New York, give me an email and send me an email and then we can meet and talk. And I was by chance next Sunday in New York, and I thought, okay, I may send him an email. I may get an answer when I'm already back in Germany. But it took only 20 minutes on a Sunday afternoon. And he was inviting me for lunch the next day in his office. And I, of course, changed all my meetings and went to Henry, and then we were during the first hour we were talking about KKR, his first deals and so on, and the whole story, and then we came up to the point disruption. And then he was also saying, look, this is what I'm saying my CEOs all the time, you are all getting disrupted from the Silicon Valley, and we are meeting here in New York all the time, but we have to meet in the Silicon Valley, and you have to go there too. Mm-hmm. And I was saying, look, Henry, good idea, but I don't know that many people over there. And then he was saying, okay, who do you want to meet? And I said, Marc Andreessen, for instance. And he took his BlackBerry, and then he arranged all the meetings. Huh? Yeah. And then I went there. And before going there, I gave a call to Christoph Käse from Springer, because they were also at that point in time in the Silicon Valley. And then they arranged also a couple of other meetings. And after 3 days, it was clear for me that things will change dramatically going forward. And that's basically where it started.
So you came back and you developed this vision, and obviously you wanted to pitch it to your board. Was it easy?
Yeah, I don't pitched it immediately, no, because it was definitely only a vision first, and the big question was how to get there. No, because when you would present something like this to the board, immediately the board was questioning, yeah, and how can we do it? What does it cost? And how long does it take? And so on. And for me, it was clear when we do it in a traditional way, it will not work. So spending a lot of money, having big committees and so on, that will not work. And then I learned already in the Silicon Valley that startups are doing it differently. Mm-hmm. But it was also clear for me that we as Klöckner are too small to be interested in the Silicon Valley. Then I went to Berlin, made a startup tour in Berlin, and there I learned how startups working. So finding out a pain point, the customer, developing after some time a first minimum viable product, testing it again with the customer, and then developing it going forward. And then it was clear for me, okay, this is the right approach. And it was also clear for me that this will not work within our headquarters. And during the startup tour, 2 days, by the way, I also went to the Beta House, the co-working space. And there was one table like this here was available. And then I asked the co-owner or co-founder of the Beta House what the table costs. And she said, okay, it costs 1,000 euros per month. And I said, okay, I'm renting now this desk. And then I gave a call to two younger colleagues and was saying to them, look, next Monday you have a new working place. Normal in Duisburg, it's in Berlin. You don't need a tie because it's in a co-working space called Beta House. And then we made ourselves familiar with this startup ecosystem. And after a while, we then started Klöckner.ai. And that was also the time where I start to mention it in our board, or also in our supervisory board, but as something as a very early stage, and also with already some ideas what we do. And so I did it step by step. So what I've not done is that I'm immediately were presenting my vision. So I first said, okay, we now have to start with the customer and to make it more convenient for the customer to work with us. We have to find the pain points and so on and so on. And so it was really a gradual development.
So there's a lot of talk that when it comes to digitization, the focus on the customer is so important. So can you tell us a little bit how you took this as an exercise to get the customers of Klöckner more into the focus, to start with their problems?
Yeah, so corporates typically say we are customer oriented, but often they aren't. Mm-hmm. Because whenever they start something, they start with themselves. Mm-hmm. When they want to make the supply chain more efficient, they don't start with the customer, they start with the old supply chain. And I think I was the same in the past. But I learned in Berlin. I learned from a meeting with a couple of people out of the startup ecosystems. They prepared for the meeting. So when I came in, there were a lot of yellow pads everywhere. And then I was asking them, "Well, look, what have you done?" And then the guy was saying, "Look, we wanted to prepare for the meeting, and we gave some potential customers of you a call and trying what the pain points are." Mm-hmm. And then I was thinking, my God, I never did it in the past. I was also visiting customers, but I was only asking, are we doing well? Are we a good supplier? And what can we do better? But I never tried to find out really what the pain points are. So it immediately was clear for me that this is the right way. Mm-hmm. And this customer ideation. And from there on, we started everything from the customer. So every development started from the customer and then backwards into the company.
But it sounds like there was a lot of going on in Berlin at that time. So how did you transfer this to Duisburg?
Yeah, it was, of course, mainly B2C. Yeah. So 6 years ago, 7 years ago, Berlin was driven by B2C, more or less. But my thinking was always, okay, when it works in B2C, it also will work at the end in B2B. Then we established this the Klöckner.ai. Mm-hmm. And hired people, by the way, not from Klöckner. So we hired people out of this ecosystem. And then the difficulty started. We developed the first tools, but of course the corporate was saying, okay, these guys from Berlin, they don't know our business, and what shall we do with this crumpy tools? And so in the beginning, we wanted to have Klöckner.ai really very, very independent. But when it's too independent, it doesn't work. That was the learning. So we try to move it closer to Klöckner, but not too close, because when it's getting too close, it also will not work. And this is the reason why most of the digital hubs of corporates are not working. Most of them fail, while it's either too close or too far away. And it took about 2 years to find the right balance. So balance in a way that people on the Klöckner side were at some point in time understanding that there could be a benefit from Berlin, and the Berlin people also learn more how a corporate works. But it's really a process. It takes some time, and it takes also then a cultural change on the Klöckner side, which we also had not really in mind at the beginning, to be honest.
Was there something special that you were doing? Were people going on tour or?
No, this after some time it was clear, okay, it's not technology alone. Yeah. When the people don't use it. It will not work. And then it was also, again, by chance, by the way, our head of IT was saying to me, look, we have this new Microsoft 365 Office suite, and with this comes Yammer. And I said, well, Yammer, what is Yammer? And he was saying, look, Yammer is something like an internal Facebook. And I said, great, what can we do with it? And he was saying, yeah, we can open it for our people. And I say, yeah, open it. And that was the first time, by the way, I was using social network because my children were not allowing me to be on Facebook. I wanted it at some point, but they were saying, look, leave us alone here. And okay, and then I learned this. But then it was also getting immediately clear for me that this is the tool we need, because with this tool, I was able, in principle first, of course only, but in principle, to get in touch with my people, which is otherwise, especially in a very decentralized company like Klöckner, not possible. So when we have 60 people in the holding and now 7,000, I think at that point in time, 11,000 in our branches. So you cannot get in touch with them. But with Yammer, it can work. That was my take. And then I start to using Yammer to communicate. And then more and more people were also communicating on Yammer, and at some point in time I was saying, look, when you I will communicate only through Yammer going forward, nothing else, only so when you want to hear where we are going or strategy and so, you have to go on Yammer. And then I started also to communicate with the people, also with salespeople, for instance, but also in a different way, not by saying, look, you have to do this, and yet by asking questions, by saying, oh, great, this problem pops up, what can we do, who has an idea, and all this stuff. And by the way, at some point in time during this journey, also my middle management came to me, was saying, look, it's great that you're communicating directly with our people. Of course, they didn't like it, but they were saying it's great, and we don't know what to do with it and how to react. And I said to them, look, I also don't know it. It's also new for me, and my suggestion is try it out. And so, more and more people within Klöckner employees were using Yammer. We were, at some point in time, we were such a heavy user that even Microsoft was sending a podcast team to Duisburg for the Ignite conference to make a video how we're using Yammer. And so that was one important cultural change approach. And the second was our Digital Academy. Okay. So because when you want to digitalize, you have all, and especially in a business like Klöckner, no one really knows what digitalization means in the beginning. And then the idea came up of a digital academy. But here again, we started also as an MVP. We, by the way, started everything as MVP. And MVP in a way that I was in Davos at this World Economic Forum, and the idea popped up, and then I gave a call to my head of HR, and I was saying to her, look, you have 3 weeks, and in 3 weeks I want to have the first two courses on our new, now founded, just founded Digital Academy. And this is where we started, and meanwhile thousands of Klöckner people are doing courses in this academy, and they can do it during working hours, which is important. And with this, we increase the digital IQ of Klöckner, mm-hmm. step by step. Mm-hmm. And I think this too, Yammer and this digital academy, were extremely important to make, in the end, digitalization successful. But again, I have to say, without a plan that popped up during the journey.
Yeah. From AT&T, there's this fantastic phrase which goes that you can be a lifelong employee at AT&T as long as you are a lifelong learner. How can you combine this with this academy approach? Does everybody needs to go through this? And what happens to people that don't go digital?
Yes and no. So it's voluntary on the one side. And on the other side, I was, of course, saying, look, it's voluntary, but it's also clear that going forward, in the next couple of years, we can only employ people with digital knowledge. Mm-hmm. And when we are transforming into a platform company. Yeah. So it's a bit of both, I would say. But we kept it voluntary because otherwise it's also then getting too complicated also with the labor. So the labor council supported it. But when you want to make courses and when you want to make, then you have to control it and then you need regulation. And so, and what we always avoided was any kind of regulation.
Okay, any scoring that
yeah, needs scoring to be. And so. But we were saying basically everyone can do courses or should do courses, of course, but everyone can also decide which courses. Yeah. So some are doing now artificial intelligence, some are more basic underway. So it's very different. But it's to be honest, it's not important which courses they take. Important is you're increasing the digital IQ.
So you talked about educating your human capital. Did you also have to educate the market on this?
I tried and I failed because after some time it was clear that it's extremely difficult to educate especially such a market. So we have thousands of customers and to try to educate, it's not possible. No? But it took some time. We tried it first, no? With flyers and with everything. No? And then we said, okay, look, then we have to do it differently. Then we have to make our customers digital, or also our suppliers, in a way that they don't have to change anything. And that came up, by the way, with AI, with artificial intelligence, and the approach is now that when a customer makes a request, request for proposal, so they typically sending us a fax or PDF or whatever, or an email, and we then digitalize the whole process. So there is, let's say, this PDF. We digitalizing the PDF, no problem. Interpretation of an unstructured document is already really a difficult AI issue. Sure. With our people in Berlin, we did it successfully. Then we have to match it with our product base because the names in Stier are not standardized. And then we have to price it, and we also have no price list, so it's volatile pricing. So we have no definite prices. And so we said, okay, then we digitalize the whole process by ourselves. So in the end, we are not complete. I think Klöckner will be finished by the end of the year with it. And when it's finished, then imagine the customer is sending a PDF or even a fax. And gets a quote within seconds, more or less real time. And typically it takes 2 or 3 days, and then it's more or less real time. And then when the customer is seeing how good that works, then there will, in my point of view, going forward, they would say, yeah, we might want an integration because it's so seamless and so on. But the learning was, don't try to change your customer. Especially in a very traditional industry, don't try to change your customer, and change your process, but in a way that you make it for the customer more convenient.
As a publicly listed company, did you also have to educate the analysts or your shareholders?
Stakeholders in general. Yeah, that was also not easy, as you can imagine. Why? Because it took honestly longer than expected. So I was convinced that that this will go relatively quick, but yeah, then we had to learn that the customers don't want to change. Your people don't want to change in the beginning. Customer, no one want to change, and so it takes some time. And we educated the analysts. We made special sessions concerning digitalization, and what our success, I would say, was in the first couple of years that they at least were saying it could be something. we are not sure yet, and we don't see any benefits yet, but it's some kind of a wild card, and it could be some. So they were not they were more or less neutral on this digitalization. But this changed then 2 years ago. It started to change, and when we last year had this big savings, because the first big benefits, really big benefits because of digitalization, it then changed completely. But in the first couple of years, it was not that easy. Yeah.
Looking at what you did, I mean, you went beyond the company, because with setting up these XOM materials, you were trying to reshape the whole industry to become more digital. How was the applause from the capital markets for this?
Yeah, some material is when you're talking about the digitalization of Klöckner, in the end, we have two streams. Yeah. So we thought in the beginning it's one, but it ended up in two. by the way, in the beginning, the idea was to first build this proprietary platform and then open it for competitors, but that didn't work in the end, also not for cartel reasons, but also internally. I would say you can change your people to a certain extent, but making them clear that the fiercest competitors are now customers on that doesn't really work.
The frenemies story doesn't compel
So we then decided, I think it was about 3 years ago, to separate XOM. To set up a new company. By the way, this is then what we had to, because we needed the approval from the cartel authorities, and we had to put a Chinese wall, we had to make a different company with different people, and so we clearly had to separate XOM from Klöckner because of the customer and competitor data on the platform. XOM is really definitely has an own strategy, and it's to a certain extent disruptive to our core business, because XOM and also our proprietary platform at Klöckner, they having the same customers, they're going for the same customers on the one side. On the other side, Klöckner, so this is a two-sided platform. Klöckner is using XOM as procurement platform because it's, I would say, clearly the best procurement platform in this business. And our Klöckner people, even if it's disruptive on the one side, they're using it on the other side because it's the benefit is so huge. And okay, now this year I think will be important to make XOM successful. XOM needs to be more independent going forward from Klöckner. So Klöckner, clearly also my successor in the end, has to decide, do I want separate business where Klöckner ends up in a minority position, where value creation comes from the value creation of the platform itself, but it's a separate business, or do I want to integrate XOM because it's a great purchasing tool to improve Klöckner without the opportunity for competitors to use it? So that's the decision now my successor has to make.
So you've already mentioned a couple of leadership learnings from your journey. Yeah. Was there anything else where you felt like, wow, I should have done this differently, or this was totally unexpected?
I would say, when I would start today, I would do it differently because, okay, we are 7 years ahead. We know much more about platforms and e-business and all this stuff and artificial intelligence. And so looking back, we, of course, had to pivot. Also, for instance, we had to pivot XOM. In the beginning, it was really more an Amazon-type platform, but then we had to pivot it because this doesn't work, at least not in the beginning in our industry, because we are a multi-local industry. So you have to, you need in our industry to make an Amazon type platform successful, you need to have in every region enough suppliers and customers on the platform, which is so difficult to achieve that all startups who tried it failed. So we had to pivot it more into a procurement platform. And when we finally have, when there are finally enough customers and suppliers on the platform, then also this Amazon-type platform works. With the knowledge of today, okay, I would say let's do it the other way around. But I would not say that at that point in time it wasn't clear. We had to make the learning. So it was a journey where we always learned something new. And then what we did is we tried a lot of things out. When there was something which we found interesting, we tried it out. And some things worked, some things didn't. And so I would say the approach was right. Go step by step to try things out, to have this MVP approach, to pivot if necessary. So it's more or less like startups doing it. So startups also often have to pivot. But you cannot then say, okay, I would do it differently.
I have a feeling that you're kind of emphasizing failure culture here as well, right? Because you tried and experimented and it failed, still you learned and moved on. Was it easy to establish a failure culture? Was it through the academy or did you have to do additional initiatives?
I think, we also tried it with initiatives. We had also this so-called fuck-up nights and it was funny. But I think in the end, the impact was not. The failure culture, we implemented it to a certain extent by communicating communicated what went wrong and what we try now differently. And I think with this step by step, people were and also, by the way, when we had our, of course, emerging leadership courses and so on, then we had, of course, sessions of failure culture. But it's also a learning. You don't have to implement everything everywhere. So when the key people acknowledge that things can go wrong and that it doesn't matter that much, then it's good enough. When somewhere in a branch in France, the head of this branch is not accepting failure, it doesn't make sense to try to change it.
But looking at your very visionary approach to leadership, because you were having a long-term idea on how the industry will need to develop itself, and of course the company needs to develop. What was this one skill that you could always rely on yourself that you would say that was the most important skill I had throughout that time?
I would say brave enough to try to try things and move on. So even when it failed, then move on and do it differently. And I always believed, I always believed 100% in this vision, I have to say. You have to keep it going. Even if it takes time, even if it takes longer than expected, even if you fail here and there, when you have in the end enough people who believe in this vision, then it can work.
Who were the most important supporters early? Who could be convinced early and was following you throughout
that time? I think in the beginning, no one really. Even also in this industry, most of the people was thinking he might be, to a certain extent, now getting crazy with this digitalization and we can take it seriously. There was, by the way, this German steel news, and there were an article, I think it was in 2014 or so, and then the CEOs of other distributors were asked what they think about digitalization, and they also were saying it's crap. It doesn't work in our industry and so on. The article was against me. I was not mentioned, but it was against me. But then, step by step, things changed. Also, then people were reading more about digitalization. The politicians, they didn't do anything, but at least they were saying they had to do something to digitalize Germany and so on. So it's it was getting more and more momentum at some point in time.
Okay, what would also be very interesting for our listeners would be, as future leaders, what would you say, what should they be passionate about? How can they drive transformation in these times? Because now I think it must be very nice for you to learn that you were right already 10 years ago. But what is it that you would say to young leaders? What should they focus on when they want to?
I think when you want to really make a company successful, especially for young people, you need also some kind of vision. Only saying we have to be more efficient and we want to be the largest and the greatest and so on, I think that's not good enough. And when I was leaving, by the way, I was telling to my people, the next big thing is ESG. Think about ESG. Think about new business models and ESG. ESG will now, for the next decades, the next big thing. And that would have been my next vision. How could Klöckner become a leader in the industry in ESG? So I think when you want to have your people behind you, really, it's not enough to be a good operator. You have to be a good operator, but that's not enough. I think you also need some kind of vision.
So you just brought up ESG. What role do you think supervisory boards have in the context of sustainability or ESG? Is there a role for them?
Yeah, of course. I think it's to some extent the same with digitalization when we started. So the role of the board is, of course, supervisory board or management board. They have to drive it into the organization, right? And because look what can happen with these in The Hague against Shell. Shell has to reduce their CO2 emissions until 2030 by 45%. So that will probably change the complete company, and what the boards have to make sure is that the companies go ahead, that they are not waiting. So, for instance, at the World Economic Forum, I was co-head of the metals and mining community, and I established a blockchain project to trace CO2 emissions throughout the supply chain, and we had discussions, and there were all the big steel and mining CEOs, a bit more conservative environment, as you can imagine. And some fear transparency, and some were saying, in the end, that was also my suggestion, was we have to do it if we want to make sure that we define the standards, for instance, and that we are not chased then from the politicians and from the regulators and from the jurisdiction. And this is now the same with ESG. You can make a business model out of it when you start early. When you start late, then you have to do it, like digitalization, but then you're being chased and you will not have any benefits from this.
Mr. Rühl, it's very impressive to listen to the story and to listen to all your experience you gained throughout these years as being really a top leader, an early adopter of digitization and a true, let's say, expert in transformation. So I think it would be nice to just, you know, as a final question, get maybe some ideas on what to read, because you mentioned before the Bible of digital transformation, but is there something new in the market that you would say is a good read for our listeners?
I would say, again, so reading Innovator's Dilemma from
Clay
Christensen makes a lot. I, by the way, went to Harvard, to a course, 3 days, and I met with Clay Christensen a couple of times later on, because I was saying to him, look, Clay, it's a great idea and great concept, but what you're missing is platform disruption. Mm-hmm. And because he wrote an article in Harvard Business Review, and there he was saying that Uber is not disruptive. And I was saying I have a different meaning because Uber is also, in my point of view, disruptive, but it doesn't, Uber doesn't came from the bottom, and so it doesn't fit in the theory. Mm-hmm. And we met a couple of times to discuss it, by the way, and it was highly interesting. So I would always read this book again. It's still a great book. Innovator's Dilemma. And then I've read a lot of books in the last couple of, there are also a lot of books concerning platforms. Some are better, some are not that good. But I would not say that there is a specific one which you have to read in any case. So. But you, in any case, Innovator's Dilemma, if you haven't read it, from 1995, I think.
Yeah, and as you said, if you read it, read it again, yeah. And try to apply what the lessons learned are from.
Yeah, because disruption is not necessarily linked to digitalization
absolutely.
Alone.
Absolutely. Yeah. Mr. Rühl, it was a great pleasure having you for our podcast today. Thank you very much for these great insights, and we wish you all the best for your future. Maybe two sentences on your future. What is coming up now?
Yeah, I'm now an investor.
And you heard that?
I prepared for the last 2 years. I prepared my future as an investor. Of course, investor in tech and also startups. Also later stage, ESG, by the way, very strongly currently. And this is my future.
Put the money where the mouse is, right? Thank you so much. Mr. Rühl. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Leading Corporate Transformation, the podcast by WHU Ottobeisheim School of Management, powered by PwC. Editorial team, Marvin Schuna and Simon Gerlach.